She went quickly down the steps, and Ben saw everything with his lover's eye. The bright tartan of her skirt, the bounce of her red hair against the back of her sweater, her milky complexion, a small healing cut across the back of one calf, and, for some reason, this last caused another wave of feeling to sweep him so powerfully, he had to grope for the railing again. The feeling was huge, inarticulate, mercifully brief. Perhaps a sexual pre-signal, meaningless to his body, where the endocrine gland still slept almost without dreaming, yet as bright as summer heat lightning. A bright golden ankle bracelet she wore just above her right loafer, winking back the sun in brilliant little flashes. A sound, some sort of sound, escaped him. He went down the steps like a feeble old man and stood at the bottom, watching until she turned left and disappeared beyond the high hedge that separated the schoolyard from the sidewalk. 4. He only stood there for a moment, and then, while the kids were still screaming past in yelling, running groups, he remembered Henry Bowers and hurried around the building. He crossed the little kids' playground, running his fingers across the swing chains to make them jingle, and stepping over the teeter-totter boards. He went out the much smaller gate, which gave on Charter Street, and headed off to the left, never looking back at the stone pile where he had spent most of his weekdays over the last 9 months. He stuffed his rank card in his back pocket and started to whistle. He was wearing a pair of Keds, but so far as he could tell, their soles never touched the sidewalk for 8 blocks or so. School had let out just past noon. His mother would not be home until at least 6, because on Friday she went right to the Shop and Save after work. The rest of the day was his. He went down to McCarran Park for a while and sat under a tree, not doing anything but occasionally whispering, "I love Beverly Marsh," under his breath, feeling more light-headed and romantic each time he said it. At one point, as a bunch of boys drifted into the park and began choosing up sides for a scratch baseball game, he whispered the words, "Beverly Hanscom," twice, and then had to put his face into the grass until it cooled his burning cheeks. Shortly after that, he got up and headed across the park toward Costello Avenue. A walk of 5 more blocks would take him to the public library, which, he supposed, had been his destination all along. He was almost out of the park when a 6th grader named Peter Gordon saw him and yelled, "Hey, Tits, want to play? We need somebody to be right field." There was an explosion of laughter. Ben escaped it as fast as he could, hunching his neck down into his collar like a turtle drawing into its shell. Still, he considered himself lucky all in all. On another day, the boys might have chased him, maybe just to rank him out, maybe to roll him in the dirt and see if he would cry. Today, they were too absorbed in getting the game going. Whether or not you could use fingers or get topsies when you threw the bat for first picks, which team would get their guaranteed last ups, all the rest. Ben happily left them to the arcana preceding the first ball game of the summer and went on his way. 3 blocks down Costello, he spied something interesting, perhaps even profitable, under someone's front hedge. Glass gleamed through the ripped side of an old paper bag. Ben hooked the bag out onto the sidewalk with his foot. It seemed his luck really was in. There were 4 beer bottles and 4 big soda bottles inside. The biggies were worth a nickel each, the Rheingolds 2 pennies. 28 cents under someone's hedge, just waiting for some kid to come along and scoff it up. Some lucky kid. "That's me," Ben said happily, having no idea what the rest of the day had in store. He got moving again, holding the bag by the bottom so it wouldn't break open. The Costello Avenue Market was a block farther down the street, and Ben turned in. He swapped the bottles for cash, and most of the cash for candy. He stood at the penny candy window, pointing, delighted as always by the ratcheting sound the sliding door made when the storekeeper slid it along its track, which was lined with ball bearings. He got 5 red licorice whips and 5 black, 10 root beer barrels, 2 for a penny, a nickel strip of buttons, 5 to a row, 5 rows on a nickel strip, and you ate them right off the paper, a packet of Lick-A-Maid, and a package of Pez for his Pez gun at home. Ben walked out with a small brown paper sack of candy in his hand and 4 cents in the right front pocket of his new jeans. He looked at the brown bag with its load of sweetness, and a thought suddenly tried to surface. "You keep eating this way, Beverly Marsh is never going to look at you." But it was an unpleasant thought, and so he pushed it away. It went easily enough. This was a thought used to being banished. If someone had asked him, Ben, are you lonely? He would have looked at that someone with real surprise. The question had never even occurred to him. He had no friends, but he had his books and his dreams. He had his Revell models, he had a gigantic set of Lincoln logs, and built all sorts of stuff with them. His mother had exclaimed more than once that Ben's Lincoln logs houses looked better than some real ones that came from blueprints. He had a pretty good erector set, too. He was hoping for the super set when his birthday came around in October. With that one, you could build a clock that really told time and a car with real gears in it. Lonely? He might have asked in return, honestly foozled. Huh? What? A child blind from birth doesn't even know he's blind until someone tells him. Even then, he has only the most academic idea of what blindness is. Only the formerly sighted have a real grip on the thing. Ben Hanscom had no sense of being lonely because he had never been anything but. If the condition had been new or more localized, he might have understood. But loneliness both encompassed his life and overreached it. It simply was, like his double-jointed thumb or the funny little jag inside one of his front teeth, the little jag his tongue began running over whenever he was nervous. Beverly was a sweet dream. The candy was a sweet reality. The candy was his friend. So he told the alien thought to take a hike, and it went quietly without causing any fuss whatsoever. And between the Costello Avenue Market and the library, he gobbled all of the candy in the sack. He honestly meant to save the Pez for watching TV that night. He liked to load them in the little plastic Pez gun's hand grip one by one, liked to hear the accepting click of the small spring inside, and liked most of all to shoot them into his mouth one by one, like a kid committing suicide by sugar. Whirly Birds was on tonight, with Kenneth Toby as the fearless helicopter pilot, and Dragnet, where the cases were true but the names had been changed to protect the innocent, and his favorite cop show of all time, Highway Patrol, which starred Broderick Crawford as Highway Patrolman Dan Matthews. Broderick Crawford was Ben's personal hero. Broderick Crawford was fast. Broderick Crawford was mean. Broderick Crawford took absolutely no shit from nobody. And best of all, Broderick Crawford was fat. He arrived at the corner of Costello and Kansas Street, where he crossed to the public library. It was really two buildings. The old stone structure in front, built with lumber baron money in 1890, and the new low sandstone building behind, which housed the children's library. The adult library in front and the children's library behind were connected by a glass corridor. This close to downtown, Kansas Street was one way, so Ben only looked in one direction, right, before crossing. If he had looked left, he would have gotten a nasty shock. Standing in the shade of a big old oak tree on the lawn of Derry Community House, a block down, were Belch Huggins, Victor Criss, and Henry Bowers. 5. Let's get him, Hank. Victor was almost panting. Henry watched the fat little prick scutter across the street, his belly bouncing, the cowlick at the back of his head springing back and forth like a goddamn slinky, his ass wiggling like a girl's inside his new blue jeans. He estimated the distance between the three of them here on the community house lawn and Hanscom, and between Hanscom and the safety of the library. He thought they could probably get him before he made it inside, but Hanscom might start screaming. He wouldn't put it past the little pansy. If he did, an adult might interfere, and Henry wanted no interference. The Douglas bitch had told Henry he had flunked both English and math. She was passing him, she said, but he would have to take 4 weeks of summer makeup. Henry would rather have stayed back. If he'd stayed back, his father would have beaten him up once. With Henry at school 4 hours a day for 4 weeks of the farm's busiest season, his father was apt to beat him up half a dozen times, maybe even more. He was reconciled to this grim future only because he intended to pass everything on to that fat little baby fag this afternoon, with interest. "Yeah, let's go," Belch said. "We'll wait for him to come out." They watched Ben open one of the big double doors and go inside, and then they sat down and smoked cigarettes and told traveling salesman jokes and waited for him to come back out. Eventually, Henry knew he would. And when he did, Henry was going to make him sorry he was ever born. 6. Ben loved the library. He loved the way it was always cool, even on the hottest day of a long, hot summer. He loved its murmuring quiet, broken only by occasional whispers, the faint thud of a librarian stamping books and cards, or the riffle of pages being turned in the periodicals room where the old men hung out, reading newspapers which had been threaded into long sticks. He loved the quality of the light which slanted through the high, narrow windows in the afternoons or glowed in lazy pools thrown by the chain-hung globes on winter evenings while the wind whined outside. He liked the smell of the books, a spicy smell, faintly fabulous. He would sometimes walk through the adult stacks, looking at the thousands of volumes and imagining a world of lives inside each one, the way he sometimes walked along his street in the burning smoke-hazed twilight of a late October afternoon, the sun only a bitter orange line on the horizon, imagining the lives going on behind all the windows. People laughing or arguing or arranging flowers or feeding kids or pets or their own faces while they watched the boob tube. He liked the way the glass corridor connecting the old building with the children's library was always hot, even in the winter, unless there had been a couple of cloudy days. Mrs. Sterrett, the head children's librarian, told him that was caused by something called the greenhouse effect. Ben had been delighted with the idea. Years later, he would build the hotly debated BBC Communications Center in London, and the arguments might rage for 1,000 years, and still no one would know, except for Ben himself, that the Communications Center was nothing but the glass corridor of the Derry Public Library stood on end. He liked the children's library as well, although it had none of the shadowy charm he felt in the old library, with its globes and curving iron staircases too narrow for two people to pass upon them. One always had to back up. The children's library was bright and sunny, a little noisier in spite of the "Let's be quiet, shall we?" signs that were posted around. Most of the noise usually came from Pooh's Corner, where the little kids went to look at picture books. When Ben came in today, story hour had just begun there. Miss Davies, the pretty young librarian, was reading The Three Billy Goats Gruff. "Who is that trip-trapping upon my bridge?" Miss Davies spoke in the low, growling tones of the troll in the story. Some of the little ones covered their mouths and giggled, but most only watched her solemnly, accepting the voice of the troll as they accepted the voices of their dreams, and their grave eyes reflected the eternal fascination of the fairy tale. Would the monster be bested, or would it feed? Bright posters were tacked everywhere. Here was a good cartoon kid who had brushed his teeth until his mouth foamed like the muzzle of a mad dog. Here was a bad cartoon kid who was smoking cigarettes. "When I grow up, I want to be sick a lot, just like my dad," it said underneath. Here was a wonderful photograph of 1 billion tiny pinpoints of light flaring in darkness. The motto beneath said, "One idea lights 1,000 candles." Ralph Waldo Emerson. There were invitations to join the scouting experience. A poster advancing the idea that the girls' clubs of today build the women of tomorrow. There were softball sign-up sheets and community house children's theater sign-up sheets. And, of course, one inviting kids to join the summer reading program. Ben was a big fan of the summer reading program. You got a map of the United States when you signed up. Then for every book you read and made a report on, you got a state sticker to lick and put on your map. The sticker came complete with info like the state bird, the state flower, the year admitted to the Union, and what presidents, if any, had ever come from that state. When you got all 48 stuck on your map, you got a free book. Hell of a good deal. Ben planned to do just as the poster suggested. Waste no time, sign up today. Conspicuous amid this bright and amiable riot of color was a simple, stark poster taped to the checkout desk. No cartoons or fancy photographs here, just black print on white poster paper reading, "Remember the curfew, 7 p.m., Derry Police Department." Just looking at it gave Ben a chill. In the excitement of getting his rank card, worrying about Henry Bowers, talking with Beverly, and starting summer vacation, he had forgotten all about the curfew and the murders. People argued about how many there had been, but everyone agreed that there had been at least 4 since last winter. 5 if you counted George Denbrough. Many held the opinion that the little Denbrough boy's death must have been some kind of bizarre freak accident. The first everyone was sure of was Betty Ripsom, who had been found the day after Christmas in the area of Turnpike Construction on Outer Jackson Street. The girl, who was 13, had been found mutilated and frozen into the muddy earth. This had not been in the paper, nor was it a thing any adult had spoken of to Ben. It was just something he had picked up around the corners of overheard conversations. About 3.5 months later, not long after the trout fishing season had begun, a fisherman working the bank of a stream 20 miles east of Derry had hooked onto something he believed at first to be a stick. It had turned out to be the hand, wrist, and first 4 inches of a girl's forearm. His hook had snagged this awful trophy by the web of flesh between the thumb and first finger. The state police had found the rest of Cheryl LaMonica 70 yards farther downstream, caught in a tree that had fallen across the stream the previous winter. It was only luck that the body had not been washed into the Penobscot and then out to sea in the spring runoff. The LaMonica girl had been 16. She was from Derry but did not attend school. 3 years before, she had given birth to a daughter, Andrea. She and her daughter lived at home with Cheryl's parents. Cheryl was a little wild sometimes, but she was a good girl at heart, her sobbing father had told police. Andy keeps asking, "Where's my mommy?" And I don't know what to tell her. The girl had been reported missing 5 weeks before the body was found. The police investigation of Cheryl LaMonica's death began with a logical enough assumption that she had been murdered by one of her boyfriends. She had lots of boyfriends. Many were from the airbase up Bangor way. "They were nice boys, most of them," Cheryl's mother said. One of the nice boys had been a 40-year-old Air Force colonel with a wife and 3 children in New Mexico. Another was currently serving time in Shawshank for armed robbery. A boyfriend, the police thought. Or just possibly a stranger, a sex fiend. If it was a sex fiend, he was apparently a fiend for boys as well. In late April, a junior high teacher on a nature walk with his 8th grade class had spied a pair of red sneakers and a pair of blue corduroy rompers protruding from the mouth of a culvert on Merritt Street. That end of Merritt had been blocked off with sawhorses. The asphalt had been bulldozed up the previous fall. The turnpike extension would cross there as well on its way north to Bangor. The body had been that of 3-year-old Matthew Clements, reported missing by his parents only the day before. His picture had been on the front page of the Derry News, a dark-haired little kid grinning brashly into the camera, a Red Sox cap perched on his head. The Clements family lived on Kansas Street, all the way on the other side of town. His mother, so stunned by her grief that she seemed to exist in a glass ball of utter calm, told police that Maddie had been riding his tricycle up and down the sidewalk beside the house, which stood on the corner of Kansas Street and Kossuth Lane. She went to put her washing in the dryer, and when she next looked out the window to check on Maddie, he was gone. There had only been his overturned trike on the grass between the sidewalk and the street. One of the back wheels was still spinning lazily. As she looked, it came to a stop. That was enough for Chief Borton. He proposed the 7 o'clock curfew at a special session of the city council the following evening. It was adopted unanimously and went into effect the next day. Small children were to be watched by a qualified adult at all times, according to the story which reported the curfew in the news. At Ben's school, there had been a special assembly a month ago. The chief went on stage, hooked his thumbs into his gun belt, and assured the children they had nothing at all to worry about as long as they followed a few simple rules. Don't talk to strangers. Don't accept rides with people unless you know them well. Always remember that the policeman is your friend, and obey the curfew. 2 weeks ago, a boy Ben knew only vaguely, he was in the other 5th grade classroom at Derry Elementary, had looked into one of the storm drains out by Niebolt Street and had seen what looked like a lot of hair floating around in there. This boy, whose name was either Frankie or Freddie Ross, or maybe Roth, had been out prospecting for goodies with a gadget of his own invention, which he called the Fabulous Gum Stick. When he talked about it, you could tell he thought about it like that, in capital letters, and maybe neon as well. The Fabulous Gum Stick was a birch branch with a big wad of bubble gum stuck on the tip. In his spare time, Freddie, or Frankie, walked around Derry with it, peering into sewers and drains. Sometimes he saw money, pennies mostly, but sometimes a dime or even a quarter. He referred to these latter, for some reason known only to him, as quay monsters. Once the money was spotted, Frankie or Freddy and the fabulous gum stick would swing into action. One downward poke through the grating and the coin was as good as in his pocket. Ben had heard rumors of Frankie or Freddy and his gum stick long before the kid had vaulted into the limelight by discovering the body of Veronica Grogan. "He's really gross," a kid named Richie Tozier had confided to Ben one day during activity period. Tozier was a scrawny kid who wore glasses. Ben thought that without them, Tozier probably saw every bit as well as Mr. Magoo. His magnified eyes swam behind the thick lenses with an expression of perpetual surprise. He also had huge front teeth that had earned him the nickname Bucky Beaver. He was in the same fifth grade class as Freddy or Frankie. Pokes that gum stick of his down sewer drains all day long and then chews the gum from the end of it at night. "Oh, gosh, that's bad," Ben had exclaimed. "That's white wabbit," Tozier said and walked away. Frankie or Freddy had worked the fabulous gum stick back and forth through the grate of the storm drain, believing he'd found a wig. He thought maybe he could dry it out and give it to his mother for her birthday or something. After a few minutes of poking and prodding, just as he was about to give up, a face had floated out of the murky water in the plugged drain, a face with dead leaves plastered to its white cheeks and dirt in its staring eyes. Freddy or Frankie ran home screaming. Veronica Grogan had been in the fourth grade at the Niebolt Street Church School, which was run by people Ben's mother called the Christers. She was buried on what would have been her 10th birthday. After this most recent horror, Arlene Hanscom had taken Ben into the living room one evening and sat beside him on the couch. She picked up his hands and looked intently into his face. Ben looked back, feeling a little uneasy.
"Ben," she said presently, "are you a fool?"
"No, Mama," Ben said, feeling more uneasy than ever. He hadn't the slightest idea what this was about. He could not remember ever seeing his Mama look so grave.
"No," she echoed, "I don't believe you are."
She fell silent for a long time then, not looking at Ben, but pensively out the window. Ben wondered briefly if she had forgotten all about him. She was a young woman still, only 32, but raising a boy by herself had put a mark on her. She worked 40 hours a week in the spool and bale room at Stark's Mills in Newport, and after work days when the dust and lint had been particularly bad, she sometimes coughed so long and hard that Ben would become frightened. On those nights, he would lie awake for a long time, looking through the window beside his bed into the darkness, wondering what would become of him if she died. He would be an orphan then, he supposed. He might become a state kid. He thought that meant you had to go live with farmers who made you work from sunup to sunset. Or he might be sent to the Bangor Orphan Asylum. He tried to tell himself it was foolish to worry about such things, but the telling did absolutely no good. Nor was it just himself he was worried about. He worried for her as well. She was a hard woman, his mama, and she insisted on having her own way about most things, but she was a good mama. He loved her very much.
"You know about these murders," she said, looking back at last.
He nodded.
"At first people thought they were..."
She hesitated over the next word, never spoken in her son's presence before, but the circumstances were unusual and she forced herself.
"Sex crimes. Maybe they were and maybe they weren't. Maybe they're over and maybe they're not. No one can be sure of anything anymore, except that some crazy man who preys on little children is out there. Do you understand me, Ben?"
He nodded.
"And you know what I mean when I say they may have been sex crimes?"
He didn't, at least not exactly, but he nodded again. If his mother felt she had to talk to him about the birds and bees as well as this other business, he thought he would die of embarrassment.
"I worry about you, Ben. I worry that I'm not doing right by you."
Ben squirmed and said nothing.
"You're on your own a lot. Too much, I guess. You..." "Mama." "Hush while I'm talking to you," she said,
and Ben hushed.
"You have to be careful, Benny. Summer's coming, and I don't want to spoil your vacation, but you have to be careful. I want you in by supper time every day. What time do we eat supper?"
6 o'clock.
"Right with Eversharp. So hear what I'm saying. If I set the table and pour your milk and see there's no Ben washing his hands at the sink, I'm going to go right away to the telephone and call the police and report you missing. Do you understand that?"
Yes, Mama.
And you believe I mean exactly what I say?
Yes.
It would probably turn out that I did it for nothing, if I ever had to do it at all. I'm not entirely ignorant about the ways of boys. I know they get wrapped up in their own games and projects during summer vacation, lining bees back to their hives or playing ball or kick the can or whatever. I have a pretty good idea what you and your friends are up to, you see.
Ben nodded soberly, thinking that if she didn't know he had no friends, she probably didn't know anywhere near as much about his boyhood as she thought she did. But he would never have dreamed of saying such a thing to her, not in 10,000 years of dreaming. She took something from the pocket of her house dress and handed it to him. It was a small plastic box. Ben opened it. When he saw what was inside, his mouth dropped open.
Wow, he said, his admiration totally unaffected.
Thanks.
It was a Timex watch with small silver numbers and an imitation leather band. She had set it and wound it. He could hear it ticking.
Geez, it's the coolest.
He gave her an enthusiastic hug and a loud kiss on the cheek. She smiled, pleased that he was pleased, and nodded. Then she grew grave again.
Put it on. Keep it on. Wear it. Wind it. Mind it. Don't lose it.
Okay.
Now that you have a watch, you have no reason to be late home. Remember what I said. If you're not on time, the police will be looking for you on my behalf. At least until they catch the bastard who is killing children around here, don't you dare be a single minute late, or I'll be on that telephone.
Yes, Mama.
One other thing. I don't want you going around alone. You know enough not to accept candy or rides from strangers. We both agree that you're no fool, and you're big for your age. But a grown man, particularly a crazy one, can overpower a child if he really wants to. When you go to the park or the library, go with one of your friends.
I will, Mama.
She looked out the window again and uttered a sigh that was full of trouble.
Things have come to a pretty pass when a thing like this can go on. There's something ugly about this town anyway. I've always thought so.
She looked back at him, brows drawn down.
You're such a wanderer, Ben. You must know almost every place in Derry, don't you? The town part of it, at least.
Ben didn't think he knew anywhere near all the places, but he did know a lot of them. And he was so thrilled by the unexpected gift of the Timex that he would have agreed with his mother that night if she had suggested John Wayne should play Adolf Hitler in a musical comedy about World War II. He nodded.
You've never seen anything, have you? She asked. Anything or anyone, well, suspicious? Anything out of the ordinary? Anything that scared you?
And in his pleasure over the watch, his feeling of love for her, his small boy gladness at her concern, which was at the same time a little frightening in its unhidden, unabashed fierceness, he almost told her about the thing that had happened last January. He opened his mouth and then something, some powerful intuition, closed it again.
What was that something exactly?
Intuition. No more than that, and no less. Even children may intuit love's more complex responsibilities from time to time, and to sense that in some cases it may be kinder to remain quiet. That was part of the reason Ben closed his mouth. But there was something else as well, something not so noble. She could be hard, his mama. She could be a boss. She never called him fat. She called him big, sometimes amplified to big for his age. And when there were leftovers from supper, she would often bring them to him while he was watching TV or doing his homework, and he would eat them, although some dim part of him hated himself for doing so, but never his mama for putting the food before him. Ben Hanscom would not have dared to hate his mama. God would surely strike him dead for feeling such a brutish, ungrateful emotion even for a second. And perhaps even some dimmer part of him, the far-off Tibet of Ben's deeper thoughts, suspected her motives in this constant feeding. Was it just love? Could it be anything else? Surely not. But he wondered. More to the point, she didn't know he had no friends. That lack of knowledge made him distrust her, made him unsure of what her reaction would be to his story of the thing which had happened to him in January. If anything had happened. Coming in at 6 and staying in was not so bad, maybe. He could read, watch TV, eat, build stuff with his logs and erector set. But having to stay in all day as well would be very bad. And if he told her what he had seen,
or thought he had seen, in January, she might make him do just that. So for a variety of reasons, Ben withheld the story.
No, Mama, he said. Just Mr. McKibben rooting around in other people's garbage.
That made her laugh. She didn't like Mr. McKibben, who was a Republican as well as a Christer, and her laugh closed the subject. That night, Ben had lain awake late, but no thoughts of being cast adrift and parentless in a hard world troubled him. He felt loved and safe as he lay in his bed looking at the moonlight which came in through the window and spilled across the bed onto the floor. He alternately put his watch to his ear so he could listen to it tick and held it close to his eyes so he could admire its ghostly radium dial. He had finally fallen asleep and dreamed he was playing baseball with the other boys in the vacant lot behind Tracker Brothers Truck Depot. He had just hit a bases-clearing home run, swinging from his heels and getting every inch of that little honey, and his cheering teammates met him in a mob at home plate. They pummeled him and clapped him on the back. They hoisted him onto their shoulders and carried him toward the place where their equipment was scattered. In the dream, he was almost bursting with pride and happiness. And then he had looked out toward center field, where a chain-link fence marked the boundary between the cindery lot and the weedy ground beyond that sloped into the barrens. A figure was standing in those tangled weeds and low bushes, almost out of sight. It held a clutch of balloons, red, yellow, blue, green, in one white-gloved hand. It beckoned with the other. He couldn't see the figure's face, but he could see the baggy suit with the big orange pom-pom buttons down the front and the floppy yellow bow tie. It was a clown.
"That's white, Wabbit," a phantom voice agreed.
When Ben awoke the next morning, he had forgotten the dream, but his pillow was damp to the touch, as if he had wept in the night. 7. He went up to the main desk in the children's library, shaking the train of thought the curfew sign had begun as easily as a dog shakes water after a swim.
"Hello, Benny,"
Mrs. Sterrett said. Like Mrs. Douglas at school, she genuinely liked Ben. Grown-ups, especially those who sometimes needed to discipline children as part of their jobs, generally liked him, because he was polite, soft-spoken, thoughtful, sometimes even funny in a very quiet way. These were all the same reasons most kids thought he was a puke.
"You tired of summer vacation yet?"
Ben smiled. This was a standard witticism with Mrs. Sterrett.
"Not yet," he said, "since summer vacation's only been going on."
He looked at his watch.
1 hour and 17 minutes. Give me another hour.
Mrs. Sterrett laughed, covering her mouth so it wouldn't be too loud. She asked Ben if he wanted to sign up for the summer reading program, and Ben said he did. She gave him a map of the United States, and Ben thanked her very much. He wandered off into the stacks, pulling a book here and there, looking at it, putting it back. Choosing books was a serious business. You had to be careful. If you were a grown-up, you could have as many as you wanted. But kids could only take out 3 at a time. If you picked a dud, you were stuck with it. He finally picked out his 3. Bulldozer, The Black Stallion, and one that was sort of a shot in the dark, a book called Hot Rod, by a man named Henry Gregor Felsen.
"You may not like this one," Mrs. Sterrett remarked, stamping the book. "It's extremely bloody. I urge it on the teenagers, especially the ones who have just got their driving licenses, because it gives them something to think about. I imagine it slows some of them down for a whole week."
"Well, I'll give it a whirl," Ben said, and took his books over to one of the tables away from Pooh's Corner, where Big Billy Goat Gruff was in the process of giving a double dose of Dickens to the troll under the bridge. He worked on Hot Rod for a while, and it was not too shabby, not too shabby at all. It was about a kid who was a really great driver, but there was this party pooper cop who was always trying to slow him down. Ben found out there were no speed limits in Iowa, where the book was set. That was sort of cool. He looked up after 3 chapters, and his eye was caught by a brand new display. The poster on top, the library was gung-ho for posters all right, showed a happy mailman delivering a letter to a happy kid. "Libraries are for writing, too," the poster said. "Why not write a friend today? The smiles are guaranteed." Beneath the poster were slots filled with pre-stamped postcards, pre-stamped envelopes, and stationery with a drawing of the Derry Public Library on top in blue ink. The pre-stamped envelopes were a nickel each, the postcards 3 cents. The paper was 2 sheets for a penny. Ben felt in his pocket. The remaining 4 cents of his bottle money was still there. He marked his place in Hot Rod and went back to the desk. "May I have one of those postcards, please?"
"Certainly, Ben."
As always, Mrs. Sterrett was charmed by his grave politeness and a little saddened by his size. Her mother would have said the boy was digging his grave with a knife and fork. She gave him the card and watched him go back to his seat. It was a table that could seat 6, but Ben was the only one there. She had never seen Ben with any of the other boys. It was too bad, because she believed Ben Hanscom had treasures buried inside. He would yield them up to a kind and patient prospector, if one ever came along. 8. Ben took out his ballpoint pen, clicked the point down, and addressed the card simply enough. Miss Beverly Marsh, Lower Main Street, Derry, Maine, Zone 2. He did not know the exact number of her building, but his mama had told him that most postmen had a pretty good idea of who their customers were once they'd been on their beats a little while. If the postman who had Lower Main Street could deliver this card, that would be great. If not, it would just go to the dead letter office and he would be out 3 cents. It would certainly never come back to him because he had no intention of putting his name and address on it. Carrying the card with the address turned inward, he was taking no chances, even though he didn't see anyone he recognized. He got a few square slips of paper from the wooden box by the card file. He took these back to his seat and began to scribble, to cross out, and then to scribble again. During the last week of school, before exams, they had been reading and writing haiku in English class. Haiku was a Japanese form of poetry, brief, disciplined. A haiku, Mrs. Douglas said, could be just 17 syllables long, no more, no less. It usually concentrated on one clear image which was linked to one specific emotion. Sadness, joy, nostalgia, happiness, love. Ben had been utterly charmed by the concept. He enjoyed his English classes, although mild enjoyment was generally as far as it went. He could do the work, but as a rule there was nothing in it which gripped him. Yet there was something in the concept of haiku that fired his imagination. The idea made him feel happy, the way Mrs. Sterrett's explanation of the greenhouse effect had made him happy. Haiku was good poetry, Ben felt, because it was structured poetry. There were no secret rules. 17 syllables, one image linked to one emotion, and you were out. Bingo. It was clean, it was utilitarian, it was entirely contained within and dependent upon its own rules. He even liked the word itself, a slide of air broken as if along a dotted line by the K sound at the very back of your mouth. Haiku. Her hair, he thought, and saw her going down the school steps again with it bouncing on her shoulders. The sun did not so much glint on it as it seemed to burn within it. Working carefully over a 20-minute period, with one break to go back and get more work slips, striking out words that were too long, changing, deleting, Ben came up with this. Your hair is winter fire, January embers. My heart burns there, too. He wasn't crazy about it, but it was the best he could do. He was afraid that if he frigged around with it too long, worried it too much, he would end up getting the jitters and doing something much worse. Or not doing it at all. He didn't want that to happen. The moment she had taken to speak to him had been a striking moment for Ben. He wanted to mark it in his memory. Probably Beverly had a crush on some bigger boy, a 6th or maybe even a 7th grader, and she would think that maybe that boy had sent the haiku. That would make her happy, and so the day she got it would be marked in her memory. And although she would never know it had been Ben Hanscom who marked it for her, that was all right. He would know. He copied his completed poem onto the back of the postcard, printing in block letters as if copying out a ransom note rather than a love poem, clipped his pen back into his pocket, and stuck the card in the back of Hot Rod. He got up then and said goodbye to Mrs. Sterrett on his way out. Goodbye, Ben, Mrs. Sterrett said. Enjoy your summer vacation, but don't forget about the curfew.
I won't.
He strolled through the glassed-in passageway between the two buildings, enjoying the heat there. Greenhouse effect, he thought smugly, followed by the cool of the adult library. An old man was reading the news in one of the ancient, comfortably overstuffed chairs in the reading room alcove. The headline just below the masthead blazed, Dulles pledges U.S. troops to help Lebanon if needed. There was also a photo of Ike shaking hands with an Arab in the Rose Garden. Ben's mama said that when the country elected Hubert Humphrey president in 1960, maybe things would get moving again. Ben was vaguely aware that there was something called a recession going on, and his mama was afraid she might get laid off. A smaller headline on the bottom half of page one read, "Police Hunt for Psychopath Goes On." Ben pushed open the library's big front door and stepped out. There was a mailbox at the foot of the walk. Ben fished the postcard from the back of the book and mailed it. He felt his heartbeat speed up a little as it slipped out of his fingers. "What if she knows it's me, somehow?" "Don't be a stoop," he responded, a little alarmed at how exciting that idea seemed to him. He walked off up Kansas Street, hardly aware of where he was going and not caring at all. A fantasy had begun to form in his mind. In it, Beverly Marsh walked up to him, her gray-green eyes wide, her auburn hair tied back in a ponytail.
"I want to ask you a question, Ben,"
this make-believe girl said in his mind.
"And you've got to swear to tell the truth."
She held up the postcard.
"Did you write this?"
This was a terrible fantasy. This was a wonderful fantasy. He wanted it to stop. He didn't want it to ever stop. His face was starting to burn again. Ben walked and dreamed and shifted his library books from one arm to the other and began to whistle.
"You'll probably think I'm horrible," Beverly said, "but I think I want to kiss you."
Her lips parted slightly. Ben's own lips were suddenly too dry to whistle.
"I think I want you to," he whispered, and smiled a dopey, dizzy, and absolutely beautiful grin.
If he had looked down at the sidewalk just then, he would have seen that three other shadows had grown around his own. If he had been listening, he would have heard the sound of Victor's cleats as he, Belch, and Henry closed in. But he neither heard nor saw. Ben was far away, feeling Beverly's lips slip softly against his mouth, raising his timid hands to touch the dim Irish fire of her hair. 9. Like many cities, small and large, Derry had not been planned. Like Topsy, it just growed. City planners never would have located it where it was in the first place. Downtown Derry was in a valley formed by the Kenduskeag Stream, which ran through the business district on a diagonal from southwest to northeast. The rest of the town had swarmed up the sides of the surrounding hills. The valley the township's original settlers came to had been swampy and heavily grown over. The stream and the Penobscot River, into which the Kenduskeag emptied, were great things for traders, bad ones for those who sowed crops or built their houses too close to them. The Kenduskeag, in particular, because it flooded every 3 or 4 years. The city was still prone to flooding in spite of the vast amounts of money spent over the last 50 years to control the problem. If the floods had been caused only by the stream itself, a system of dams might have taken care of things. There were, however, other factors. The Kenduskeag's low banks were one. The entire area's logy drainage was another. Since the turn of the century, there had been many serious floods in Derry, and one disastrous one, in 1931. To make matters worse, the hills on which much of Derry was built were honeycombed with small streams. Tyrault Stream, in which the body of Cheryl LaMonica had been found, was one of them. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.